Good morning, everybody. TGIDF.
What does that stand for again?
That means that stands for, thank goodness, it's Divorce Friday.
Oh, very cool. Well, good morning, Diane. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
Thank you all for coming to this episode of the Divorce Friday podcast. It is the podcast that addresses your financial questions about divorce. So I am Chris Chen. I'm a certified financial planner in CDFA Newton. And you are, Diane?
I am Diane Pappas. I'm a certified divorce financial analyst and a certified quadro specialist in Gloucester, Massachusetts.
Great. And today we have a guest. Guest is David Consigli. David is a CPA and a business valuator. And you want to tell us a bit about you, Dave?
Yeah, sure. Like Chris said, I'm a CPA. I value businesses. That's all I do. I'm a partner at Ferraro Amodio in Zarecki. We're a small boutique firm. Our main office is actually in Saratoga, New York. I am the Boston office of FAS, as we call it. I spent my career in public accounting. I've been in public accounting for over 35 years. I started doing business valuations and I call it divorce consulting work, probably in the mid 90s. I think 1996 was my first business valuation for a divorce. It always intrigued me. I love the valuation part of it. I started to, 6 years ago, made the decision that I wasn't going to do any more accounting and tax work. I probably made that decision 15 years too late. But nevertheless, started doing it full time. So now all I really do concentrate on is business valuation for, you know, divorce, shareholder disputes, estate tax planning, and forensic accounting. And some of that based on what the discussion today will be about income.
Yep.
Thank you, David. So you let the cat out of the bag. So today we're discussing income, business income in particular, and how we determine business income for purposes of child support. It's sort of surprising, we were having that discussion right before, that it is as difficult as it is. So you will find our contact information on the Facebook page. It's facebook.com/divorcefriday. And if you haven't already, please like the page or follow it. If you found us on Twitter, it's @divorcefriday. Follow us there too. So if you have any questions that you would like to have asked, please put them on the Facebook page and we will address them. You can also reach either Diane or I at divorcefriday@gmail.com. The email gets to both of us and we will answer depending on who is the best one to answer it. So at this time, let's get into the meat of the subject. We're talking about business income. So Diane, do you want to get it started?
Sure. So we were talking last week with, our attorney friend there. Yes. And we were discussing how can we have a conversation about child support without talking about income? So, you know, we know that the child support guidelines and the worksheet is just a formula that you plug in the numbers. But you have to know what numbers to plug in. And those, the two numbers that we're talking about today are the income numbers for both parties. And when you're a W-2 person and you're a straight salary with no bonuses, no commission, no nothing crazy, it's very simple. But as we know, and David, as you will really do a deep dive into today, when you're trying to calculate income of a business owner, it becomes very difficult. And okay. So one of the things that we, maybe to start off, because there's so many places we can just hop in here, but the guidelines speak to income available to pay child support. So that's what we're looking at, is the income available to pay child support. And that might not just be something that comes in your paycheck every week. It might be other places. But what is the definition of the income that's available to pay child support? Like, what would you call that? What would you say that definition is?
So what I would say is, you know, for starters, it's almost what is, what is available to that person, you know, what benefits do they get? What is that person gets, whether it's through, you know, starting with W-2 wages, and then any other miscellaneous things that that would be available to you.
Can we just use an example of what one of those miscellaneous things that are available
to you? So what I was going to say is, and you know, my background is business valuation, right? And I'm gonna kind of use the two as a, you know, kind of analogous, right? So when you look at, because it's very similar to when what we do when we look at value in a business, it's almost like cash flow to the owner. And what we do is we may start with net income, and then from net income we say, okay, what adjustments would we make, right? And when I look at, say, an individual, I often look at what would that individual make if they were to go work for somebody else, and what would that salary be? So as an example, I might be a business owner and I may pay myself a salary, and then I may get different perks because I'm that owner. So I may get an automobile. You know, I may pay my car payment through the business. That's income to the owner, right? If I bought that business, if I'm an outside person and I bought that business, would I give you the car, you know, or is that just a discretionary item, right? You know, mainly other types of perks, you know, maybe it's country club dues, maybe it's, you know, meals and entertainment that get run through the business. And it's very important to determine what's necessary and what is required and what's necessary to run that business. All the other expenses that aren't required or necessary to run that business could be considered income to that business owner.
Right. I mean, a prime example is a business that pays for a box at Gillette Stadium.
Exactly. And,
that's a necessary expense, isn't it?
No, not in my book. It's not.
Unless you work for the Patriots.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. So David, it sounds like what we would do with that is we can add that right back to the bottom line of income and make that available for child support.
Exactly. So like if I use the business analogy, you know, what I'm going to do with a business is I'm going to say, okay, let's start with net income. Right. And in addition to regular W-2 wages. So really you'd probably start with W-2 wages. Then you're going to add back net income. And then you're going to look at the expenses and you're going to say, okay, if I were, and I say this to my business valuation clients, what I'm going to do to find out that cash flow to the owner, what would I pay for if I were just to buy your business and you were going to run it? You know, what would your total compensation be? So I will look at the expenses and I'll say, okay, I'm going to add back your meals and entertainment. I'm going to add back your auto expense because you probably don't need it. I'm going to add back the box at Gillette. I'm going to add back, you know, your kids' cell phones. I'm going to add back your mother's cell phone. I'm going to add back your, you know, the trip that you took to Las Vegas to go to 5 conferences because I might only pay for one. You know, we recently had a case where client lived on an island, had to travel to go to all these things off island, but they weren't necessary to run the business. It's right. Like, you know, you can go to, if you wanted to, you could go to 20 conferences a year, but do you have to?
Right.
I'd like to basically stop there a little bit, because I think, so you're saying, if there are things that are not strictly necessary, then they should be added back. So if I make, say, $250,000, pay myself $250,000, and then I take 10 conferences that cost me, say, $15,000, then you want to add $15,000 to my income. Yeah. Right. So I have a technical question first, which is, so that $15,000, if I were to spend $15,000 myself to go to those conferences, I would have to account the pre-tax value of that. And so what you're just adding there is essentially the dollar value, which is post-tax, right?
Well, it depends on the business entity, right? Because we're talking like pre-tax income.
Right. And so the other question is that you're getting, what you're suggesting is that we're going to get reasonably deep into the running of that business. So who is a judge to say that I should go to 3 conferences instead of 5?
Yeah, it's very subjective. And, you know, I think us as financial people, we're the ones that need to be reasonable about that. We're the ones that need to do our homework. So, you know, if you're talking about a CPA, right? I had a call with one of my partners right before this, and we were talking about conferences. And we're saying, you know, I told him, I said, I usually go to 2 a year. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe we go to 1 next year, and maybe we each pick 1 to go to. And you might have to ask 5 different people, how many conferences you go, you know? And it's up to us to do that reasonable check, you know, fair check, not being biased to either party to say what's the true number. And in our professional opinion, 2 conferences is the average of the 5 people that we, or the 10 people that we interviewed or emailed and asked them, how many conferences do you need to go to?
Right.
But then that person, the business owner, where you want to increase his income, and now he's shaking in his boots because his income just keeps going up and up. But he's like, but wait a minute, I'm allowed to take those deductions. How come I can't do, you know, why do they have to be added in back now? You know, I'm allowed to.
Yeah. And that's one of the most confusing parts that I find explaining to clients, that there's a big difference between something that is discretionary, right? Something I might do, but you might not do, but Chris might do that I might not do. There's a difference between discretionary and tax deductible, right? So there's 2 components to this. Number one, we have to find out things that really aren't tax deductible that might be being deducted, you know, and add those back. And then the other ones are the discretionary items.
And that's, so let's get back.
That's the challenge.
Let's stay on the discretionary for now.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a difference between being discretionary and tax deductible, right? Discretionary is just what we just said. You're going to 15 conferences, but what's the right amount of conferences, right? And that's why there's some discretion there. You know, charitable contributions, another one. You know, we'll add them back. You know, if I were, my wife might be listening to this. She might say, are you planning on something? But if someone were to plan, on it, you know, knowing, and this does happen, people say, hey, look, I this marriage isn't going to last a year. What I'm going to do is I'm going to ratchet up my charitable contributions through my business, because I'd rather give it to, you know, charities than to pay in some type of support. So I'm going to give $10,000 this year when I usually give $1,000. You know, is that fair to use that whole $10,000? Perfectly tax deductible. You know, the IRS doesn't have a problem with it. But right. For purposes of, you know, support payments, it's a discretionary item, right, which would get added back.
So getting back to another item that you mentioned there about entertainment and stuff and the Gillette box. I think it is a normal business expenses in some lines of work to have a Gillette box. Mm-hmm. That's where you entertain customers. That's where you make deals.
Right.
And to add it back out just because it could be discretionary, aren't you going to call the entire marketing budget discretionary?
Not necessarily. I mean, and again, and that's where, as the financial person, you need to do your research. You know, what are other businesses in the industry doing? And again, how I explain it is, I always look at the business, and this is how I analyze it. I first look at the business and say, okay, if I were to buy the common, if it's a corporation, if I was going to buy the common stock, and I'm going to buy, you know, Chris Chen's Divorce Friday podcast, right? And, but I'm not going to, you guys are still going to run it.
Available for free on Facebook Live.
And you'll have, I'm going to buy your podcast, and you guys have a box at Gillette. Am I going to pay for that box for you to do your podcast? Right. And if I say no, I'm going to add it back. And, you know,
So you're saying it's a judgment call.
It's a judgment call. That's why it's called discretionary. Now, on the other hand, if you're going to, you know, 2 divorce conferences a year, you know, that's discretionary. I could say it's only 1, but you're going there, you're meeting people, and you're driving, you know, income to your podcast. That'd be nice. Right. and you're driving people to your podcast that's creating income, then I'm probably not going to add it back because it's probably, you know, it's probably reasonable. And it's subjective. It's why, you know, I think I told you guys before we hit the record button, you know, I've testified twice in the past year just on income calculations. So you think about it, something that's so simple actually goes to court over what they are, because there is some subjectivity. There's a lot of subjectivity to it.
Okay. Yeah. So we addressed here the discretionary expenses of a business. We address that the discretionary expenses can be subjective. And so we're relying here on the good judgment of people like us to figure out what is and what isn't, right? But you were, you mentioned just briefly earlier about expenses that shouldn't be taken, that are, you know, beyond discretionary, if you will, right? So you want to tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah. These would be items that, you know, maybe business owners are a little too aggressive, let's say, on their tax return. Another discretionary just popped into my head, is our wages paid to kids, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And that takes a little deeper dive of getting a breakdown of who's on the payroll. Even non-working spouses on the payroll, which are, quite frankly, are great tax tools. You know, having your kid do a small job and paying them maybe a little bit more than what it's worth, that's a great tax deduction.
Mm-hmm. And tweaking the retirement plan so they can
retirement plan contributions and things like that. These are all great tax tools, but they're also income to the owner. Right. So, and then the other part is kind of dives more into the forensic accounting, where forensic accountants may go in, look at certain things. I've had engagements where, you know, there's just a lot of personal expenses being run through the business, anywhere from mortgage payments, on the house to, kids' cars, you know, spouses' cars, those aren't discretionary. that's not in compliance with the tax law.
Yeah.
You know, things like that. Personal things, you know, repairs and maintenance, looking at repairs and maintenance accounts because, you know, I bought materials to redo my kitchen through my business.
Right.
You know, and also each business. Each business is so different because, you know, a construction business, you know, I don't want to say most construction businesses do this, but some small construction businesses will do repairs and rehab on their own home and buy the materials through their business because, you know, maybe because it's just easier because they're buying those materials anyways and they forget to add them back, you know, or
because it's less expensive also.
It's also less expensive and, you know, and it happens.
And you help reduce taxes.
Absolutely. And those are harder, you know, discretionary expenses you can usually see on the surface, right? You know, there's certain ones that are just there, like the meals and entertainment and the, you know, maybe the marketing, the advertising or client expenses, however they're classified. The non-deductible items are usually found in a deeper dive on some type of forensic accounting engagement.
I remember one time I had a client who, now a lot of the companies that people that I work with have much smaller companies than what you're talking about. We're going to get into that in our next question, the different types of ownerships that we're discussing. But I mostly have people that are S-corps or, you know, a single member LLC or something like that. But I had one person who I got a couple of years of their tax returns, and the year before, had a huge write-off for attorney's fees. And like, okay, what is this? You know, so again, this is something that didn't occur all the time. And all of a sudden this $30,000 thing showed up. So right. We questioned it because, like you're saying, that is something went on there. And this is actually the income we were going to be using for alimony or child support, whatever. So we had to take a deeper look at that and say, you know, we should be adding this back.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I know most CDFAs, and this is kind of my suggestion, is a lot of times I think 3 years is kind of the period you may look at. I always ask for 5 years.
Yeah. When there's like, a business involved.
Yeah. I want a business cycle, you know? Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we do, one of the things that's good to do is to put all 5 years, you know, on a spreadsheet and take a look at legal expenses. Cause you can see it, you know, 5,000, 5,000, 5,000,
30,000, 5,000, 5,000. That's what I saw. Let's just address that very fast, right? Is that normally lawyers will ask for 3 years worth of records. And so you're suggesting here that for a business, it should be 5 years?
I always look at 5 years.
Okay.
You know,
that's a great idea.
Here's the other thing too, that you have to be careful about. And it's exactly what you just said, Diane, especially if it's in that last year, is there's also things that are non-recurring, right? So, you know, and this comes with experience, right? So I'm sure now you always look at legal expense, right? Because it happened to you once, and now you're always looking at professional fees to see like, all right, are they paying for their divorce attorney? You know, are they paying us through their business? You know, like where's the money, where's it coming from? But also too, it could certainly just be a one-time thing where someone decided to sue them, they had to defend themselves, but it's only happened once in the 20 years they've been in business. So we look at these as non-recurring items also. So you may have a high expense. You may look at that expense and say, gee, it's high this year. What happened? This is a one-time thing. It's not going to happen in the future. We'll, you know, I'll add that back too.
Okay. I had a guy that was running alimony through his, he was paying alimony on a 1099 and running it through his business as an expense. I was like, no, you can't do that.
Yeah, so, there are people who pay college tuition through their business.
Right. Yep. Right. So what I want to do now is just because we have our, you know, the audience out here might not be as savvy about the different types of businesses that we're talking about. And so I just kind of want to go over the basic structures of what we typically see. Yeah. So I'm just going to, you know, we see Schedule C businesses, partnerships, S-corps, and C-corps. So do you want to just take like Schedule C and tell us what that person does? Like how are they being paid? What are they doing?
Yeah, so.
A quick second there. So Schedule C is basically, just try to explain that a little bit, right? Is sole proprietorships, and it is a single member LLCs.
Right, exactly.
Is there anything else that fits as a Schedule C?
That's pretty much it. So, yeah, you know, Schedule C is the reference is to that's the form that sole proprietors fill out, summarizing their profit and loss from a business on their tax return.
Right.
So that's where that term comes from. It's the schedule that gets that business owners that are not incorporated file on their tax return. So that'd be sole proprietors and single member LLCs.
Right.
So
and LLC. That's what I am. I file my Schedule C. I'm a single member LLC.
LLC being a limited liability company. So
right. Just to explain a bit further, right, is that a single member means a single owner. It's one person has 100% of the ownership.
Right. Yeah. So you know, a single member LLC is one person, one member. LLCs are the equivalent of partnerships. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's kind of the legal liability protection that you get of having a, you know, separating your legal liability in a limited liability company versus a sole proprietor where, you know, you're from a legal standpoint, you're subject to liability as if an individual. Now, right, from a tax standpoint, if you're a single member LLC and you're a sole proprietor, then the income gets taxed federally, it gets taxed on the state level, and then also what's called self-employment tax, which is basically Medicare and Social Security. So when I work for, you know, I work for a firm, I get paid a W-2, I get Social Security withheld from my paycheck, and then my firm matches it. When you're a single member LLC or a sole proprietor, you pay both halves of that Social Security.
Right.
So should that be taken into account when we calculate the income of the owner of that LLC, meaning that they pay 7.5% more than a W-2 person pays?
That's an interesting question. I don't know if I've come across that.
Mm-hmm.
Be something to consider. You know,
Chris always comes up with those little things. he always throws us for a loop here.
stump the CPA. This should be called.
Right. So when we consider a couple divorcing and one has W-2 and the other one has 1099 income, then it seems, or Schedule C income, it seems that there is 7.5% of.
There could be, and of course it depends on the income level too, because they both could max out, and then it would only be 1.45%. So, you know, you gotta look at each case. So, you know, single member LLCs, Schedule Cs, those are one person ownership. A regular limited liability company is the equivalent to a partnership. They're both taxed the same way. They're both fill out the same form, 1065, to do their tax return. The income that they make is also subject to self-employment tax. So partnerships on the income that each partner gets also pays FICA, and then they match their own FICA. So it's the same thing. So it's the same as the tax is pretty similar to the sole proprietor and the single member LLC. The only difference is it's a different tax return because there's more than one member, as opposed to, which is the equivalent of owner. So member, shareholder, owner, all interchangeable.
So one of the great benefits of LLC for some people is that it is known as a pass-through corporation. And what that means is that there is no double taxation. There is the taxation at the company level, and then taxation at the individual level is all taxation at the individual level. And so the other form of organization that is similar to that is the S-Corp. You want to tell us a bit more about the S-Corp?
Right. So an S-Corp is also another what we call flow-through entity. So in other words, there's no tax at the corporate level. The corporation files a tax return but doesn't pay any tax. In Massachusetts, there's an excise tax for the S-Corp. It's like $456. And on the LLC, there's a $500 annual excise tax, or I forget what they call in the LLC. But what happens is each shareholder gets what's called a K-1. And the K-1 shows the income that they've made on their pro rata share, whatever percentage they own of that income. And then that gets reported on their individual tax return. Now, the difference between an S-Corp and an LLC is that the S-Corp income is not subject to self-employment tax. So there's not that double taxation. However, the flip side is an S-Corp is required to pay W-2 wages. So if you're a sole owner or you and a partner and you're working in the S-Corp, you're required to pay a W-2 wage on the S-Corp. So in essence, you know, depending on the ownership, but if I'm a single person, a sole owner of an S-Corp, I'm the only shareholder, and I pay myself, you know, $50,000 in W-2 wages, I'm still gonna pay both halves. It's just the company's gonna pay it through payroll taxes versus me paying it through individuals. And the caveat to that on the subject that we're talking about is you know, how S-Corp shareholders will avoid that double taxation by taking some distributions as opposed to W-2 wages. You know,
let's take a step back. What we're saying is that the S-Corp owner gets a salary from the company that is a W-2 salary, right? Yes. And that salary has a limit. And the company income in excess of that salary, the profit that the company gets is then flowed through the owner as a dividend.
Yes. Well, it's flowed through as income.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so then, it gets taxed differently also.
So it gets taxed. So then that gets taxed. So you'll get taxed on the W-2 income, and then you'll get taxed on any income left over after all the expenses are paid.
Yeah, that's going to show up on your K-1.
And that's going to show up on your K-1 on your individual return. Now, what that income, what you're allowed to do, and in much more complicated conversation than what we're having here, but what happens is that income now, you're allowed to withdraw that income out of the company tax-free.
Right.
Because you already pay taxes on it. Mm-hmm. And what gets complicated is it's called basis, and it goes up by income, down by withdrawals, and certain other things that are limited. You know, you can't take more than your basis, but that income, generally that income, you know, that $10,000 of income every year that you might have, you're allowed to take that out as a distribution, and it's tax-free.
Right. So in other words, there is some adjustment that may need to be done to a business owner's income if they have an S corp.
Exactly.
Right. So the last, the other interesting case is that of the C corp.
Yes. So the last entity is a C corp. I don't see many C corps from the businesses that I deal with, because generally small businesses are not. It's not the best tax advantage. What happens on a C corp is you get taxed at the corporation. Any net income gets taxed at the federal and state level, and then the distributions that you take out on an S corp that are tax free. If you take distributions out of a C corp, then they get taxed as dividends, just like if you got a dividend from Google. Mm-hmm. Is Google public? I don't know.
Google doesn't pay dividends, but that's Microsoft.
So, like if you had owned publicly traded stock and got a dividend, that gets taxed too. So there's a double taxation. There's one at the corporate level, and then when you take the money out, you can take it out as salary, you can take it out as dividend. It's going to get taxed at the individual level.
So it would seem that from a divorce standpoint, a standpoint of trying to recognize what is the income of the business owner, that the C corp might be a little bit tricky in the sense that they will present their W-2.
Yeah. Right?
And it is not everything, because the corporation could be retaining some of that other income.
Some of that, right, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And, and what gets tricky, what's even trickier sometimes is the S corporation. Because what the S corporation will do, you know, I mean, I had my own accounting firm for like 20 years. And one of the things we used to do with the S corps is say, you know, look, take a minimum salary, mm-hmm. you know, as much as possible on your W-2. Because again, you're paying both halves of that Medicare and Social Security tax. And then you'll pay the federal tax on the net income, but you can take that out, you can take that distribution out, and that's tax-free. And that distribution, what the money you save is the FICA and the FICA match. So you'll save an extra 15% in taxes if you do that. So when we're looking at, what's the income of an S corp, you know, you really have to be really familiar with an S corp return to be able to look at what is their income on that return.
Right. So here's the problem I get with a lot of people. So I mostly see S corps, partnerships, mostly see S corps. So they will, when you look at the S corp or even the partnership return, there'll be compensation of officers. And if there's just one person or two, you know, that's where they're being paid. That's their compensation. And then they have the net ordinary business income, hopefully not loss, but income that gets carried forward to the K-1. So that person will say, well, yeah, but I don't get that money from the K-1. You know, yes, we had a profit and my 50% share is 60,000, but I didn't get that. And I'm like, but it says here that on your K-1, you got a distribution. Right. So you did get something. That's always the hardest thing to explain to the client and even attorneys.
Yeah. And you know what, it's one of the reasons, you know, how I said the 5-year thing with businesses, because it's much easier to look at a 5-year history of a distributions, because mm-hmm. distributions usually lag, right?
Yes.
You know, sometimes you don't take the distribution until after the first of the year, because you need to know, what do I owe in taxes? What do I have here? What's available? And right. then the flip side too, sometimes the distribution is just to pay the taxes.
Right.
So, you know, the client may get a K-1 that says $10,000 and owe $2,500 of taxes on that $10,000. So, you know, like I used to, you know, consult with my clients, I'd say, well, take that out of the business, because that's really the tax on the business. And they wouldn't take any other distributions beside that. You know, so that's really it's kind of a tax payment.
You're basically saying that there are some categories of incomes to the individual that should be excluded.
Yeah, and on the flip side, now the other thing's even complicated even more. That bottom line net income from the business might not also be the net income from the business, right? Because there may be other things. I don't know if now's the time to talk about them. Could be like depreciation items. There could be, there could be other on the K-1. What happens is there's some deductible items that are separately stated. And basically what that means is that they're only deductible subject to certain income limitations. So there may be things in there that you might have to adjust. For instance, one of them may be gains or losses on sale of equipment. You know, they may have that may include a gain or may not include a gain on a sale of equipment that is really not necessarily a gain, so to speak. It could be fully depreciated and they got $1,000 and it's, it just gets more complicated. What I mean? So you really have to know your way around the S corp return.
Right. So what are the major ways that businesses can legally manipulate income? So manipulation has a bad name, right? It's but you can affect that income legally for different kinds of business purposes that sometimes also can work in divorce.
Yeah. And I think, again, that this kind of goes back to the confusion of like what you can do for tax purposes that don't necessarily equate to income. You know what I mean? That these are things that, are just good tax planning strategies. And that could be accelerating expenses. If you have an S corp, that's on a cash basis of accounting versus an accrual basis of accounting, right? And, cash basis of accounting basically means you recognize income when you receive it, okay, or when you constructively receive it. So what that means is, one of the strategies is sometimes business owners will hold checks at the end of the year. Not really supposed to. If you can cash the check, you're supposed to cash the check, right? If you receive the check, you're supposed to record that as income, right? Kind of one way they might manipulate it is they don't.
So
look at January's deposits, right? And see what they're made of.
So a business can, like you were mentioning, defer income, right? By either holding checks, which like you're saying, they're not supposed to, but do sometimes, or also by sending an invoice later.
Right, holding on to invoices.
Right.
Not paying invoices, accelerating expenses.
Accelerating expenses. So that means paying something in the current fiscal year that is for use for the next year. So I have an example of that is that I have a software provider that has sent me the opportunity to pay for all of next year ahead in this year. Right. So that would reduce my increase my expenses, reduce my income and reduce my taxes this year.
Right, writing out your rent on December 31st instead of January 1st.
For instance, yeah.
What's the difference? It's probably going to get cash the same period of time. So, those are things, and especially if the business is on a cash basis, which you recognize income when you receive it and you take the deductions when you pay it, then those are perfect tax strategies. There's nothing wrong with that. The businesses that are on an accrual basis, which basically says you have to report your income when you earn it, and then you have to report your expenses when they're incurred, right? And there's this matching principle, like the income that you report, you want to match the expense that you needed to generate that income.
Right.
So that becomes one is just tax strategies. The other one might be more on the forensic digging deeper.
Right. So when it comes to figuring out income for child support purposes, so we might need to go a little bit deeper into the analysis of these financial statements.
Exactly.
Yeah, right? But then I'd also want to ask or add, how far are you going to go? Because this can get very expensive. How deep and how far are you going to go? And I think a lot of times, what you're saying, David, I know just costs a lot of money to do all that type of forensics and whatnot. So, you know, I think a lot of times people just need to understand these things and then acknowledge that it can be very expensive to go deeper. So let's try to find something that works for both of us.
Yeah. And again, kind of going back to the 5-year thing again, another reason why I look at 5 years, because when we're talking about these things, they're especially accelerating expenses from 1 year to the next, it's really just timing differences.
Right.
So if you're doing the same, if they're doing the same thing, let's every take the year. cash basis taxpayer, you know, like I would say to my clients, well, if you're going to pay your rent on December 31st this year, you got to do it again next year, because then you're going to have 11 months rent paid instead of 12. And it's really, you know, not going to really help. It's going to hurt you next year. So when you look at a 5-year period, you know, then when you look at like the average of the 5 years, it should come out pretty close, because these are really just timing differences, you know, which is much different to, you know, forensic analysis, right? And there is not, I think every time I get a referral to do a forensic a divorce, there's always a forensic piece. And I always say to the client, okay, well, one of the things we'll be able to do is take a look at it and see if we think there's anything going on, and also talk to you on why you think that, because you could spend $10,000 for us to do a forensic engagement and find nothing.
Mm. Right. Yep. I think the reality is that businesses don't have like airtight books, and you'll almost always find something, but it's going to be minimal.
Right. And you know what, we do it so often, we just know where to look, you know. And Diane, your example of the legal is perfect, because that only has to happen to you once, where you you look at it every single time. And, you know, I wouldn't be able to name them off the top of my head, but I probably have 15 examples like that. You know, because we do this all the time, where we, you know, where we're looking at things and saying, you know, because we've also said to clients, it might not be worth it, you know, do it if you want, but, you know, what's your, you know, how much do you want to dig in, and what benefit is it going to get you?
Yeah.
Right. I think that's really the issue, is because the benefit is uncertain, and the cost is much more defined. And so in many cases, it's probably better to forego it, especially if the parties are otherwise reasonable.
Yeah. What I think is more important is making sure that you're capturing the correct income off like the S-corp return or the partnership return. You know what I mean? Because it's not as easy, or it doesn't stick out as much as you think, if you're not familiar with those type of tax returns.
Well, you know what? Let's just dive right into retained earnings.
Mm.
Because that's the one that I want to know. So, so retained earnings in an S corp. So I've had a business, he pays himself a salary. So this is a single person, pays a salary. They are a company that's not seasonal. So it's not like they had to, you know, stock a lot of money for over the winter months to get by, but that their retained earnings were incredibly high, for what I felt was the, you know, that should be in there. And our guidelines for the child support also say to us, that, you know, the undistributed earnings, it says here that, is there an attempt to shield income by means of retained earnings? So can we discuss that?
Yeah. In my initial answer right off the top is, it depends.
Yeah.
like anything else.
I'm sure.
We don't like that. We don't like those two words.
No. So first of all, what is retained earnings?
Right.
So day one, I start my S-corp, I put $100 in the checking account. That's my capital stock. So I have $100 in equity. First year, I make $10,000. So now that $10,000 of income becomes my retained earnings. The next year, I make $10,000. Now I have $20,000 of retained
earnings. $10,000 that you made that did not distribute.
That I did not distribute, right?
So did you pay earnings, you paid yourself, though. You did pay yourself.
On a W-2, maybe on a W-2.
Okay, you paid yourself.
I'm talking after you paid yourself on a W-2.
Okay.
$10,000 in
profit. in profit.
Now that becomes my beginning, that profit becomes my beginning retained earning balance.
Okay.
Retained earnings goes up each year by whatever income I made. It goes down by any distributions that I take out of the company.
Right.
Okay. So it goes up and down by up by net income, down by losses. Any losses I deduct reduces retained earnings, up by any net income, up down by any distributions. Okay. So, So now, you know, and I think what the guidelines, it's a little bit confusing because, you know, when you're talking about income, you know, I almost look at retained earnings. Number one is you're going to look at things like, you know, if I'm not paying distributions, you know, and I have that ability, so I have that ability to take that money, but I'm not taking it, my retained earnings is probably going to be higher than it normally would. But however, I think what complicates this is, you know, income versus asset, right? Mm-hmm. So if that retained earnings is in cash, and I'm going to look at the value of that business, one of the things I would look at is if there's excess retained earnings and there's also excess cash to offset it, because, like, you know, usually there has to be some type of asset there,
right?
Then that excess cash gets added on to the end of the value of the business.
Okay. Right. So I have a question with respect to how it connects back to those child support guidelines, because Diane brought up, I forget exactly what the phrasing is, but basically look at retained earnings, right? I think what it means is that retained earnings in the current year should be income, but retained earnings from previous years are really an asset.
Right. That's how I would look at it. I would look at it as an asset, really not income, because, you know, you look at, and this happens a lot when we value a business, where people will say, well, you know, book value is higher than higher or lower than the value of the business. And, you know, book value is an accounting term, right? And book value is basically the equity, the retained earnings. And, you know, it becomes complicated because then now you have to do a calculation. If you have excess retained earnings, that's money that could have been distributed from the company, but wasn't. So you have to look at, well, what happened to that money? And you do that by looking at the balance sheet. Like I said, is it in cash? So do they have $1 million in cash when they only need 300, right? So that 700 becomes another asset of the shareholder, you know, and it's really the shareholder, not necessarily, you know, it's in the business, but it's really the shareholder's asset. And you, or maybe it's, you know, other non-operating assets. You know, did they go buy a boat? Did they go buy a condo? Did they go buy a thing? And, you know, it's funny, when I do a business interview, I always ask, do you have any non-operating assets on the books? And, you know, never expect them to say, and they'll go, yeah, we have a boat.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have a condo. You know, where is that on the balance sheet? And it's buried somewhere. You know, so like for me, for the guidelines, I agree, Chris, I think it's more of an excess asset that you have to almost account for than, because the income, if it's a flow through entity, you know, the income is going to be there on each year's tax return.
But you would still have to look at past year's retained earnings to figure out if it is something that happens normally, if you will, to average it the same way that you might average other business income, so that you can add it.
Right, especially if you're looking at that 5-year period, because a lot of times indication of income can be distributions. You know, I've had cases where I've testified that, you know, the income is $250,000 a year, and they're saying, well, no, it's not. I'm not getting $250,000 a year. And I'm like, well, look at the history of the distributions. You've taken like at least $200,000 or $300,000 each in the past 5 years. So if you've gotten it. Now, the other thing too, is you gotta be careful, because distributions aren't always necessarily I wrote out a check. It could be some of those personal expenses get reclassified as distributions.
Right, and so, one of the things that happened during the pandemic is that many businesses had a reduced revenue and reduced net income. And so you are talking about the past 5 years, right? So should the pandemic situation be counted separately, or should it be included in the average of the past 3 or 5 years or whatever?
Yeah, I mean, again, it depends. I think you have to look at the, you know, you have to look at the business. You know, there's, you know, when I say you look at a 5-year period, you look at a 5-year period if it's applicable to what you think is going to happen going forward, right? If it has no indication of the, you know, the path. So, you know, you might look at a 5-year average of a business that's stable, of a business that's what the indication of the future is going to be. If, you know, I mean, I just looked at a business yesterday. We only used the last year because they doubled their income and they said that's what's going to happen going forward. You know, so the prior 5 years really didn't matter of averaging it or doing, you know, some type. So, you know, depending on the business, and I can give you an example. I have a client that has a home and garden center, and, you know, their profits were, you know, decent every single year. During the pandemic, it was 7 times the profit they had in prior years. Like, you know, some people think a lot of businesses have been hurt, and it's true, but also there's a lot of businesses that really benefited. Yes. And when I talk to that client and they say, well, there's no way this is going to continue. I mean, people during the pandemic had to go outside. They did their yards over and they did their planted new shrubs. They're not going to do it every single year, you know? So when we're projecting what their income is going forward, it's much different than what it was this past year. Right. Again, it just complicates things because it makes it more subjective. And, you know, and I think the lesson is, you know, shameless plug for us three, is that you hire people like us to look at it and you know, work with us to determine what that's going to be.
So how might you deal, David, with businesses that have either a reasonably strong growth or, you know, reasonably predictable decline? So let me go for the latter one, because it's much tougher for our divorce situations. Is, say you have some gas stations, right? And so my personal forecast is that gas station revenue are going to go down over the next several years because of electric vehicles.
Right.
And so you have a business that provides income, and we should reasonably expect that income to go down.
Yeah, you really have to rely on, and you know, you have to do your homework. You really have to rely on industry reports. You have to rely on, you know, what the industry forecasts are, what the experts in that industry are forecasting, and hopefully apply it to your specific case and why your case is going to be, you know, you think is going to be along with the industry, and why, you know, you think that it's not. You know, like I said about the home and garden center, you know, the industry outlook in that industry is not 7 times net profit, you know, going forward. It's actually projecting to be a decline, you know. So then you have to look at, okay, how long, when do we think that decline is gonna happen? You know, it's gonna happen overnight? Probably not. So now we have to do some type of forecasting. And the thing with forecasting is forecasting never comes out the way you forecast it, but you wanna get it as close to possible as you can. Every now and then I get someone and say, oh yeah, the forecast was like right on. And I'm like, oh really? Wow, that's great. We both did a good job.
You know, I think in this situation though, for child support, let's remember what we're talking about here, is that that's when modification can come into play. If someone's income goes down, they come back for a modification. You know, I think that's probably the better way to handle that type of income. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So in your experience with child support, David, because that's really what I want to know here. When do you average, and how do you do that? When you average a person's income, let's just say 2 years, okay, for a child support order, how does it typically go forward? Is that just set forever, or is there a true up? How have you seen that handled?
I've seen it both ways. I've seen where, you know, you might take, and especially when you're looking at things like, and this also probably applies to people that get bonuses or commissions, right? Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. where we look at that and we say, okay, well, we don't really know what it is, so we're going to base it on what it's been in the past. And, you know, and we're going to estimate what that was in the past. And that's, and like you said before, that's what it's going to be set at. Now, if it changes, you have the option of modification, you know, and sometimes people will agree, you know, people that are going through divorce, they have choices, right?
Yeah.
You know, they can negotiate, you know, what they want. They can negotiate what they believe the income to be. And it could be like, okay, well, there could be a modification based on, you know, we already know that it might change, or if there's a chance of change, and that if it does, we're going to modify the income ourselves, or we're going to, you know, determine what that child support is. So, you know, the thing about divorce, I'm kind of preaching to the choir with you guys on this, but not only with divorce and businesses, is that every case is just so different. Yeah. And you have that choice to, you know, get together and figure it out and, you know, try to do it as equitable as possible.
Yeah. And we try to do that, but sometimes, you know, people view equity and fairness differently. Yeah. So one of the things that somehow we missed talking a bit about was depreciation. Right? So depreciation is common in businesses with equipment, is common when you have rental properties and stuff. And it is sometimes forgotten. And sometimes it's a surprise to the owner. But so tell us, why is depreciation an expense that we add back in?
Yeah, all depreciation is when you buy a piece of equipment or a building or, you know, a car or whatever through the business, is you're really writing that business off on over the useful life of that asset, right? So if it's year four, let's say it's year four and I'm writing that asset off, I might have already paid for that asset, but I'm getting a deduction because I'm not allowed to deduct the whole thing in that year. So it's a non-cash expenditure. It's a non-cash item that gets added back because it's really not a true cash expenditure, you know, for that business owner. Right.
So it's a non-cash expense that basically the IRS allows you to take on your tax return, and it reduces your income and therefore your taxes, and therefore for child support we add it back in. To reflect that, but also what happens with that is that if in the year that we're considering this, we have the business has a major equipment purchase, right? That is also except for Section 179 equipment, they cannot. It will not be written off that year, and so it has an impact on the cash flow, which doesn't reflect an income.
Right. Yeah. And you know, so the flip side of that is, you know, from the adding back the depreciation is determining, you know, what might that business's annual capital expenditures be, because that's a true cash expenditure for that business, right? So, you know, that's something that you might have to take into consideration. You might have to take a $5,000, you know, CapEx expense off that income because that's a true cost. Where depreciation, you know, if it's unless it's the year that you actually spend on the equipment, it's not a cash expenditure. It's just something that's written off over 27 and a half year period, 39 year period, depending on if it's a building. So, yeah. You know, you have to, but also too, in this, you know, every question becomes more complicated as we talk about it, right? If I have a cash expenditure for equipment, but I got a loan for that equipment, I'm not going to deduct the cash expenditure because I got the loan. What I'm going to be able to deduct is the interest on that loan every year. So then I don't have to take into consideration. So, you know, every item you have usually has a few follow-up questions to that.
Okay, so we're coming to the end of our time. And so I think the summary of that is that business income can be complicated.
If you didn't know that before, you definitely know it now.
Right. Yep. And determining income for purposes of child support is even more complicated because it requires judgment calls that we may not make on a day-to-day basis. Right. So I just need to remind everyone that circumstances are different for everyone and that a podcast will not replace a consultation with a professional. Mm-hmm. So if you are seriously considering divorce and you have a business in your life, whether it is yours or your spouse's, you should get a consultation with a professional. So next week, we're meeting again on Friday at 11 a.m. And Diane, what are we talking about next week?
You always ask me, Chris.
That's because I always forget.
No, I always forget too. I think we're talking about the factors in a case that may affect child support.
That's correct. Yeah. So next week, our guest is going to be Sandy Lundy.
Yep. Attorney Sandy Lundy.
And she will be addressing the factors. And what that means is that there are different factors that are considered in figuring out child support. And we will have an in-depth discussion with her about that.
Yeah, I just want to add one more thing. So people who are listening, they're going to say, okay, you know, we've got Chris and Diane who are CDFAs. We have David who's a CPA business evaluator. So one thing that the way that a someone could use our professional, you know, our services is to hire someone like Chris and I. And then we would say, you know what, we really need to bring David in as an expert to help with the income piece. So that's just one, I think, a really good way to let the public know that there are ways of doing this that are not all or nothing. And that, you know, you can just bring in, you know, the people to help you on specific issues, which in the long run, depending on the income and the business, could be very, very good to do.
I think, funnily enough, I think we did address that in our first episode last year. And but anyway, so it was episode one, and it is available on Divorce Friday, the divorcefriday.com, our website, and check it out if you're curious.
Yep.
All right. Thank you, everyone, and I'll see you next week.
Yep. TGIDF. Thank you, David.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All righty.